failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. Century of Lies is a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The marijuana industry has grown dramatically over the past few years, and if legalization is allowed to continue rolling out under the next president, then that growth will continue. It could be massive. Marijuana prohibition, all drug prohibition really, is rooted in racial prejudice and bigotry. Merely legalizing marijuana will not change racially biased law enforcement or our racist criminal justice system. Legalizing drugs does not address those issues, but that's a topic we'll deal with in a later show. On today's show, we're going to look at access, inclusion, and diversity within the marijuana industry. As these companies grow and prosper, will it be classist and racist business as usual? Or will the marijuana industry reflect the progressive ideals espoused by the marijuana legalization and drug policy reform movement? Back in August, Seattle HempFest held a panel on diversity in the marijuana industry. Speakers included activist and comedian Ngaio Bilom, activist and businessperson Ned Fortune, the New Jersey weed man, activist and normal board member Madeline Martinez, businessman and entrepreneur Jerry Whiting, and activist and businessperson Trista Ockel. The panel was facilitated by Dominic Korva, Ph.D., the founder and social science research director at the Center for the Study of Cannabis and Social Policy. Let's listen. The first voice you hear will be Ngaio Bilom.
My name is Ngaio Bilom. I've been an activist for more than a marijuana activist for more than 20 years, mostly a comedian. I also write. I'm a marijuana advice columnist for the Sacramento News Review, Monterey County Weekly. I've written for Alternet and Guardian. I write for THC News, the National Edition, and the Colorado Edition. I used to publish West Coast Cannabis Magazine. I write for Cannabis Now Magazine. Blah, 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 blah. I love marijuana more than most people. No, wait. I love more than marijuana more than I love most people. But look, the thing about the diversity issue is we have to make sure when we first started all this cannabis legalization, it was mostly because social justice, right? And stoners didn't want to be bothered. Stoners just wanted to be able to smoke weed and be stoners. And now that we see this gigantic explosion of business and commerce, we have to remember the social justice aspect, right? And so cannabis freedom can't still mean exclusion of minorities, right? You see where I'm coming from? It's, when you're an outlaw, it's easy. You get a pound and a pager, you're a businessman, right? But now, pager, because I started in the 80s. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yourself. Just beat me, dog. I'll call you back from the payphone. But now it's a whole different thing, right? Some states you need $1 million in the bank before you can even ask to get a medical marijuana license. And so we have to make sure that the barriers to entry are relatively low and that people who've been most adversely affected by the war on drugs get a chance to get a slice of this new cannabis pie. You know, I think Oakland's been doing some things to ensure that minorities and women of color get first crack at it. Crack, maybe not the best word to use, but I think that's the biggest thing is we have to, it's incumbent upon the people who are reaping the benefits to make sure that everybody else gets a chance too and to open it up for everybody else. We can't just be selfish because that's not what weed is about. That's all. All right.
I'm Madeline Martinez.
Hi, Madeline.
Hi. That was very nice, Ngaio. I'm on the board of directors of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. I'm really proud of that. First Latina woman on the board, so it was inspiring to me. I also opened the first cannabis cafe in the United States.
Yeah. It's world famous.
2009, added the name World Famous when the Associated Press told me I was world famous. Because I had no clue, I was stoned. Bought the name at night with the Secretary of State's office, and I was, did it. And then we opened, and when we opened, we sent out a nice press release, and I was inundated with calls. Even Al Jazeera called me for an interview on the phone. And I said, come on, you guys are busy. But anyway, I also was the executive director of Oregon Normal for about 9 years. And we created the largest chapter in the United States. And as Russ Balville says, in the known galaxy. So it's really exciting to do some of those things and to grow that organization over 3,000 and have just enough gumption to open that cafe without asking anybody for permission or doing any of that stuff and just moving forward because I wanted to, because I felt that we deserved a place of our own out of public view. And so we did it, and it was a success. Until recently in March, I had to close down for the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act. And there's a lot more we're going to talk about, I'm sure.
Yeah. My name is Jerry Whiting. I own LeBlanc C&E. I am most often associated with CBD and medical cannabis, among other cannabis activities that I do. And in thinking about this panel, two things came to mind that I hope up Dominic. One is, how do we get here? And in thinking about the industry, and I travel around the country and I've talked with people in Ohio and Colorado and Oregon and it reminds me of high tech. I've been in high tech for over 30 years, and when I started, you know, I was characterized by A, knowing my B, being one of the few black faces in the building, let alone the room. And there's stories that Dom and I talked about of showing up in business casual clothing, like everybody else, to a big company that I'm not going to name. Where do I sign? I'm not the messenger. I'm here to see your boss's boss's boss. Or the other side, you go to an all-day conference in one of these big hotels, and of course there's lunch in the middle of the day with an 8 or 10 top table, and you're all sitting around in your business casual clothing. And the people who are working wear those little short polyester things. Do you want chicken or fish? Which did you order? And then there's that look when they pass the plate to me and they realize, my God, it looks like me. And there's that glance like, yep, I'm here. So in cannabis, I get that same thing. I had a son that started LeBlanc with me, and we were well known, A, because we had great genetics, everybody wanted what we had, but more importantly, when we walked into an event, just like software 30 years ago, we were some of the few dark faces in the room. So how did we get here?
You're not even that dark, really.
Sorry. Thank you, brother. So how did we get here? I think in large part it is the legacy of prohibition, the war on drugs, in that when it was criminalized, it was done by criminals. And if not by criminals, people who were treated that way. Who did you trust? Your own. You trusted your family, the people you grew up with, the people in the hood. Those people tended to be like you. And so we came into this age of legalization and medical marijuana that's sweeping the country, still carrying the burden of prohibition because people didn't trust each other when we were made to be criminals. So part two, looking forward, I would propose, and Don really gets mad at me, a very small change. A couple years ago, I made the decision to use the word cannabis, and I don't use the word marijuana, because marijuana was used by Anslinger to demonize cannabis by associating it with people of color, specifically Mexican Americans and Hispanics. This is but one instance of racism being used to suppress us in addition to depriving us of access to our favorite plant. So by using cannabis, I'm discussing the drug cultivars, the food, fuel, and fiber hemp cultivars, because they're all under siege. And why? What's the big deal? Isn't it just a matter of words? No, because every time I deliberately use the word cannabis, it's an opportunity for me to engage one-on-one with the person I'm speaking with to give them a little history, a little teaching and preaching. So, looking forward, will that tumble the rock over the ledge? Probably not. But it's a chance for me to reach out to an individual in the moment to say, no, I tend to use the word cannabis for a reason, and here's why. This is the history, this is the context, and knowledge is power. And if nothing else, it's power and money that dictates who plays the game, whether it's cannabis, oil, food, or anything else. I'm done.
That's great.
Thanks, Jerry. We could talk later why I disagree with him on the marijuana thing. But that's great. Let's move on. Tristan, Ed Porchon has joined us after all. He was stuck in traffic. We are searching for his name badge, but we will put him right after Trista. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Trista Ogle, and my company is Empower Body Care.
Woo!
Yeah.
We make topicals. I've been in the movement since 2004. I guess I was in the industry before it was an industry as well, in my 20s. That's a whole other story. And I didn't have a pager, I'm not that old. So, it's an honor to be on this panel. And at first, when I was first invited, I had to really think about whether or not I really wanted to talk about inclusion and privilege in the cannabis marketplace. I do as much as I can to not seem too different, really. But I am, and I look a little different than others sometimes, and it does make a difference, I've noticed. So this is exciting. Thanks for having me.
I apologize for being a little late. I ran into a Seahawks traffic jam. I'm Edward Fortune, and I'm glad to be invited to be on this panel, Inclusion and Privilege. You know, I've had my issues over the years, and one of the issues I always talk about is the fact that I believe that people of color are excluded from this new emerging marijuana industry, this multi-billion dollar industry. And it's not done by just putting a sign up and saying whites only. That's not how it's done. It's really done by power and money, like the other speaker mentioned. It's a power thing. For instance, I live in New Jersey. And New Jersey technically is a medical marijuana state. But the only people who can say have a dispensary, we call them ATCs in New Jersey, are politically connected, very rich guys. In New Jersey, it's only five of them. And they eliminate anyone who has any records, anything to do with marijuana prior to us being legal. You can't belong to the New Jersey medical marijuana program. I couldn't be a bud tender or a door opener in New Jersey because everybody gets a background check and my marijuana arrest will come up. And that's basically all I ever have. I've had multiple marijuana arrests over the years and that excludes me. At one point, I even had a dispensary in Los Angeles, and at the time, in 2008, there were about somewhere between 800 and 1,000 dispensaries. And at one point, I actively went around trying to find how many of them were black-owned. I mean, there were a lot of Mexican-owned ones, and there were Armenian-owned ones, and Russians, and Jewish, and white-owned, but there were less than 20 that were owned by black people. And for whatever reason, I don't know why, there were a lot of underground distribution centers that were controlled by black people. But for whatever reason, laws, you know, statues, whatever, we just aren't included. I guess we can move on from there.
We're listening to a panel discussion on inclusion and diversity in the marijuana industry. It was recorded at Seattle Hemp Fest back in August. Speakers included Trista Ogle, Madeline Martinez, New Jersey weed man Ed Fortune, Jerry Whiting, and Ngayo Belum. This is Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Let's get back to that panel.
I think one of the challenges is the people who are coming in with all the money have to make sure that they're including other people, yeah. Right? Like Chris Rock says, white people created racism, white people need to deal with it. You know what I'm saying? So it's not up to black people always to stand up and be like, hire me, hire me. Y'all need to be out looking for cats. Y'all need to be out trying to find women. Y'all need to be out trying to find people who might know things, especially if you're new to the cannabis industry. Maybe you want to talk to somebody who's been in the cannabis industry, whether underground or above ground, for a few years and bring them on board and figure out how stoners actually work, because it'll save a lot of money and hurt feelings if you have an idea on that first. I don't think hopeless is the right thing. I just think we have to make sure not to overregulate it and make sure that people who want to get into it have a chance. I mean, the challenges before, the reason you didn't see more black people owning dispensaries in the outlaw illegal days is because they come after black people first. My boy Virgil Grant had 3 dispensaries in LA all by the book, all by the book. The man is a stickler, and he just got out of jail for 6 yep. years from the feds. You understand? And everybody else still has a club, right? So now that it's more legal and more open, we just have to make sure that everybody gets a chance. And that's on the cats coming in. That's not necessarily, I mean, you know, we can stand up and yell and make things. I'm on the board of the marijuana or the Minority Cannabis Business Association, and we're doing things. And Virgil just started one in California for California cannabis growers. But that's it. But the people who are coming in and the people who know the people who are coming in, got to make sure that these guys know what's going on and to make sure that they get involved. You got to hold everybody. When you see all you white people, no, mad love. But when you sit around in your business meeting and you see a bunch of white people, ask everybody else. Ask somebody. Be like, man, it looks awfully white in here. Studies show that businesses and companies with more diverse employees and more diverse labor bases make more money and are more efficient.
Yep.
All right. That's it. I'm done.
You did give me one thing to address my hopelessness, which was actually lower regulatory barriers to entry. Looser regulatory structures, basically.
Yes.
That was actually, in addition to what you were saying, which is also true, that white people actually have to exert their privilege to change it. They're the ones with the privilege to begin with. Jerry.
So extend the parallels to high tech, which started in people's basements and garages, if God knows my software company did. I would love to see people of color, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, everyone, that communities act like communities, pool their resources. In high tech, it's the first interstate of mom and dad, friends and family, before you go to the angel investors. There's a way you raise money if you're headed towards an IPO. People in the hood may not know it, but look, you know, you do the friends and family after you do the credit card kind of thing, you know, Robert Townsend School of Finance. But then you do go to the first interstate of mom and dad. Then you go to friends and family, and then you build on that.
The challenge on that, though, is mom and dad are probably broke, too. I mean, generational poverty.
Now, wait a second. Not all black people are
broke. No, I'm not saying all black people are broke.
That's not, you know, no, that is not true.
No, this is definitely true. Too Short will tell you there's money in the ghetto. But I'm saying that it's not as prevalent always that
that's
someone's
why
parents
I'm suggesting
are
suggesting that we do it.
Well.
I know
well,
it's
well,
not
I have
prevalent.
To, I have to tell you, I come from a family that's really not poor. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up in the city, but when I tried to hit up some of my family members to invest in the marijuana industry, they instantly think police. I'm not getting involved. And the police, that scariness of the police is very prevalent in the black community too, so they've shied away from the marijuana legalization industry also. And when I bring it up to other people, like say, you know, I get the eye rolling too. You know, as soon as I start saying, hey, you know, let's be more inclusive. You know, hey, I'm a black man. I would love to represent your product, this, that, and the other. And it's like, I played the race card and they don't want to play no more now. You know, like I get that. You know, if I bring it up, if I don't bring it up, they're like, it just doesn't happen. It doesn't occur. It's this thing that just doesn't exist. Mm. And I find that to be amazing too, because I look at, say, Sanjay Gupta's specials, and I saw this hour-long special, and not one black person was in it. Mm. And I was like, wow, that's like a 1950s movie. Yeah. Or Donald Trump's Make America Great thing. Anyway, oops, I shouldn't have got political. But that's what I find. That's what I find a lot when I try to push the envelope. You know, you said there's no hope. Yeah, like I said, people roll their eyes when you bring it up.
How about Tristan Madeline? Would you like to weigh in?
Well, you know, I wanted to say that I know a lot of people are stopped by the color of their skin or perhaps because someone's judging them, but I have the ability to just go and open a door and my friends are all white, and I'm a brown person, and I too was asked to become part of the Minority Cannabis Business Association, and I actually am. And I thought that was kind of strange because I was always segregated in my life. I come from East Los Angeles. And so we lived in the barrio, and when I came out of living in the barrio and lived in the real world, where there's more white people than us, except in California, right? They think we're the minorities, but we're not. Anyway, what I was going to say is I've never found it to be a problem for me. I just go open the door and go in. People are like, did they stop you? I said, no, I wish somebody would try to stop me because I want to know, I would like to engage with these people, but I have never had that problem. When I first got to Oregon, I had the problem with the guys ran all the marijuana issues. The guys. Sometimes you hear banjo music in the background when you see these guys. And they didn't really like the idea that this little brown lady came in here and went and did try to do some legislation, and I didn't check with them. You know, and I said, well, I read it, and it said I could do it. I'm not always a proud Oregonian, but I live there. I chose to live there. You know what I mean? I don't like the racism and all that. And I don't go to Estacada because they say they don't like us there. So I don't go there. But I do go wherever I want, and I say whatever I want most of the time. I try to be measured at some point. But I think as far as this inclusion, I kind of get the sense that if we have a Minority Cannabis Business Association, are we resegregating ourselves? You know, I don't want to do that. I want to stand up and be a person. I mean, you can see what I am. Obviously, I'm Mexican and Navajo. I mean, I don't know if you know I'm Navajo, but I'm actually Native. So, I don't know. I have a problem. Even when people say, hey, you broke the glass ceiling. And I'm like, there wasn't a glass ceiling. I created this position. So I really have a hard time understanding a lot of the, what did they, stop you? Well, they tried, but I'm not gonna let them stop me. I always say, be the change you want. Look in the mirror and say, I want this to happen, I want this to happen. I don't go to country clubs or golf courses. I don't wanna go there. I'm probably not, you know, welcome there.
I'm a pretty good golfer.
But I don't like to go to cigar bars or hookah bars either. You know, I don't like tobacco. So cool. But everybody should have that choice. But my thing is, I want people to stop going to prison for pot. I used to work for the Department of Corrections in California. And as I went down the halls to take count of these inmates, I could smell marijuana wafting down the halls. They can't stop it from going into a maximum security prison with the Mansons. They're never going to stop it. So I worked really hard in Oregon to legalize, and I wanted to make sure that we were taxed so we could have that freedom. You know, so we could grow 4 plants. No paperwork necessary in Oregon. As long as you're 21 and you keep it out of public view, you're good. You can have 8 ounces of stored marijuana off those 4 plants, and then I guess the rest, you know.
I wanted to talk about your point of the... Okay.
So, I also created my own position, right? And that was probably the most direct way to avoiding any sort of judgment. Or, I don't know, any sort of apprehension from anyone else was to start my own company, right? And to start with, so EMPOWER stands for End Marijuana Prohibition, Organized Women Enact Reform, right? Or Enacting Reform. So focusing on women and focusing on empowerment. You know, getting people out of pain is empowering, right? And once you feel out of pain, it's a lot easier to behave in a more empowered manner, right? So you can help others. And I find that by staying true to that course, I'm able to avoid a lot of situations that would normally, or in another industry, would hold me back. So that's how I That's how I avoid it. However, still, sometimes, because of the way I look, I'm sometimes ignored, or things that I try to ignore myself, pretty much.
Well, to refocus the broader theme onto the class intersectionality, which is kind of what it's my fault, I'm throwing that on them, they're not doing this to me. It figures the white guy is doing it. But if you don't want to segregate, but in fact doing, like, networking small businesses, for example, turning a weakness into a strength by gaining flexibility and, resiliency in your networks. You know, that's seems to me an interesting way to go. And by focusing on the sort of, socioeconomic margins, you're bound to get a more diverse crowd that way. Seems like a possibility. What do you think?
I just wanted to address Madeline talking about groups like the Minority Cannabis Business Association and other spots. I don't think it's necessarily a way of setting yourselves apart or setting another group apart. As it is, it's empowering people and bringing people together. Maybe there's somebody, it's collective economics, right? This is what happens. Larger, non-diverse groups with more money come in and try to push everybody out the sphere, right? So now maybe you meet someone through this business, through this association, who has a business similar to yours. You guys can pool resources and create better economies of scale. Maybe someone has gone through a similar situation. You have peer-to-peer resourcing and counseling where you can talk to each other. You can throw job fairs in the hood and show people who no one, until the past 3 or 4 years, people haven't even considered that you can actually have a career in marijuana. It's not just being a weed man or having a side hustle, but there are actual legitimate careers. Managing a cannabis club is a skill set, right? Knowing how to break down a pound into an eighth is a skill set, right? Knowing all these things, these are all, it's true, it's a skill set. Yeah, it's all customer service, all this marketing, it's a skill set. And so I think that we have to make sure to remind everyone, men, women, gay, lesbian, transgender, if you have weed skills, you should be able to get a job in the weed industry.
That was from a panel discussion on inclusion and diversity in the marijuana industry, which was recorded at Seattle Hempfest back in August. Speakers included Trista Ockel, Madeline Martinez, Jerry Whiting, Ed Fortune, the New Jersey weed man, Ngaio Bilam, and Dominic Korva. Finally, earlier this week, the legendary singer-songwriter James Taylor announced that he is canceling a concert in the Philippines. Taylor is on a world tour and had been scheduled to make an appearance in Manila. He's canceled that concert in protest over the human rights violations and officially sanctioned campaign of murder being carried out in the Philippines at the order of that nation's dictator. Thank you, JT, for taking a stand. Remember, folks, until Duterte is finally removed from office, it's hashtag boycott the Philippines. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The Drug Truth Network is on Facebook. Please give its page a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give it a like and share it with friends. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course, also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back next week with 30 minutes of news and information about the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.